Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. My name is Paula Thompson. I'm your host, and with me are my dear friends and co-hosts, Marvin Garwin. Welcome back, Marvin. Chuck
Thank
Thurston
you.
And Andre Rodas. Hi, guys.
Yay.
Good morning,
Paula.
Yeah.
Good morning, guys.
Good morning. Yay. Good to have you back, Marvin.
Good to be back, Paula.
You know, I love our theme song, Annie Zonneveld, and it's the poem by Sufi poet Rabia put to music, and it's so beautiful. And I love that she ends it with the word God, because for me, when I say God, the biggest part of that is awe. I always marvel that awe. Is the main, you know, emphasis, God. I love that.
Yeah, I hadn't noticed that before.
Yeah, it seems appropriate to me that awe would be the biggest part of God. And that's true for me anyway. We are at the end of paper 2, The Nature of God. We're doing 5 papers in a row, which is pretty unprecedented for us, actually, but they're just such marvelous papers. And today is Section 7, Divine Truth and Beauty. And, wow, that's going to be wonderful to read about that, just like all of these readings have been. And so far we've covered the nature of God, the infinity of God, the Father's eternal perfection, justice and righteousness, the divine mercy, the love of God, the goodness of God, and now today we'll finish this paper off with divine truth and beauty. So that'll be great. I'm so glad the 4 of us are here to do it. Pam would be here today too, except she has to help her daughter recuperate from a surgery. So we're wishing you well, Pam. And so any thoughts about this paper as we get ready to tie a bow on it?
Let's jump in.
Section? Let's jump
in.
Okay.
Well, there, one thing I could point out is they're filling in the second two characteristics of this triad of divinity, which is truth, beauty, and goodness. That's how we usually, it rolls off the tongue. But
that's
true. The goodness of God in section six, and now in this section it's going to be truth and beauty. So that's a kind of a completion of that triad concept that we've all become so familiar with when studying the Aransch book. I really like how those three qualities kind of give us a guide for divinity, you know, how we can sense divinity through truth, beauty, and goodness, or even cultivate it within ourselves. And then those three qualities are often sort of almost like the idea of love going through a prism. It's kind of the first three colors are truth, beauty, and goodness. So like that metaphor
as well. Primaries.
Yeah. So the section, was it the section before? Yeah, section before was the love of God, section five. So we go from love of God and then into these three qualities of divinity, goodness, truth, and beauty.
Go ahead, Marvin.
Well, I mean, another thing that kind of occurs to me is just sitting back and getting a feel, sort of a soul feel for each of those three values, the three essential primary values of God's nature. I mean, initially, I associate truth with mind and beauty with the physical creation and goodness with soul or personality functions, you know, interrelationships between persons. But actually, I think each of these is much more subtle and much more far-reaching than that simple equation. Because I think truth is much more than an intellectual reality. I think that's part of what they're trying to tell us, is truth is also beautiful and good, and goodness is true and beautiful, and beauty is true and good. Anyways, all of those associations, each of these have a primary quality to them, but they're much more subtle and profound realities than a simple equation with physical reality, mind or reality, and soul or personality reality. Anyway, yeah. And you know, part of that is that we'll be discovering how profound these realities are all the way into eternity. We're really fledgling in our efforts to understand them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So true. You know, I always loved Jim Downs's chart of positive qualities, because at the center of the, you know, and the qualities go out he has a big circle, and the qualities go out from the center, which is love. And then you have goodness, beauty, and truth. And then all the qualities start to go out from those three great realities. But at the center is love. Mm-hmm. And based on the teachings that I love and most resonate with, including the Course in Miracles, that's love is the great motivation of all that is good and beautiful and true. You know? So it is the one primary driving force of all that is meaningful and valuable in our lives spiritually, and I've come to believe that, you know, fear is the antithesis of that. You're either in a state of love or you're in a state of fear. So love and faith, right? Faith is another one of those primary values, but when you're afraid, that's the cause of all of the negative things, you know, anger, hate. Those are fear is that what drives those emotions, and love is what drives everything good. That's oversimplistic, probably, but. I always appreciated that about his chart, the chart of positive qualities. Interestingly, I've seen that chart in a lot of chiropractors' offices. So,
really?
Bravo, Jim Downs. Yes, I have.
Well, very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. It resonates.
Yeah.
I wonder if Jim knows that.
I don't know. I should tell him sometime. I've seen it in more than one, which is interesting to me. And I, you know, I'm a person who believes in chiropractic, so I've been in several different chiropractic offices over the years. And I've seen Jim's
chart. Well, it's interesting that fear, I think, is based in physical reality. It's based in our animal nature.
True.
It's, you know, it's in our hormonal system, and it's a survival trait. You know, fear is purposeful. But once you've gotten past the survival stage, it's actually very counterproductive. And I agree with you, Paul, that's sort of at the opposite end of the spectrum of love, which is, I think, the most profound spiritual reality.
Yeah.
And the other thoughts that occurs to me is that love, the only way love makes sense is as a factor between persons. It's a relationship factor. You know, we've talked before, the way love is used in our language, you know, I love pizza. it makes no sense. You know, love is really only a spiritual, profound spiritual reality, and it's a phenomenon between persons that happens only from one person to another.
Mm-hmm. Well, the other thing about love is that it's creative. You know, at least in your actual definition, of the desire to do good, you know, to another. So that's like doing something, actually making something happen. And that's a creative engagement. So that's the other thing about love, I think, is important. Whereas, you know, on the other side, you get into all the destructive, you know, anger is destructive, hate is destructive. So those are the, you know, very clear division and qualities there between actually making things better and just wanting to destroy whatever it is that's, you know, making it. Unhappy,
yeah, I think it's animal fear that makes us really dangerous as human beings, you know, because we have just enough ability to act on that fear, and you see it, you know, we get carried away by our fears.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah.
Anyway.
So, yeah.
And then there's also, of course, the triad architecture does run through so much in the Urantia book, misconceptually. So when we have these threefold combinations, you know, that's always kind of can somehow be seen within this larger architecture triad dynamics. It's like dynamic systems usually have a triad, whereas a structural system tends to be, you know, have symmetry qualities, whereas a dynamic system, like love, is a dynamic engagement, you know, and so it makes sense that it would have a triad architecture kind of hidden within it, or has as its means of manifestation, you know, we'll find a triad dynamics. So, you know, even the idea of body, mind, spirit, that's a, you know, again, a triad system that is the dynamics of our organism, you might say. But I agree that truth, being, and goodness can be mapped all kinds of ways. I mean, they all touch each other and manifest on all levels. But
yeah,
you know, like you were saying a minute ago, Marvin, you know, it's like you can have a beautiful thought. You know, a beautiful thing doesn't have to be a physical object or something that's true, you know, can operate, you know, spiritually or even physically. So it's interesting how those qualities combine in different ways.
Yeah.
But they are a litmus. They're kind of a litmus in a way. I think that's what's interesting about these three qualities, truth, beauty, and goodness. You know, when you see that, you know there's divinity somewhere hidden in whatever system you're looking at.
Yeah. And I'm fascinated with triads. And I always think, okay, which one represents Father, which one represents the Son, and which one represents the Infinite Spirit? Mm-hmm. And in that original Trinity, you know? So looking mm-hmm. at beauty, truth, and goodness, I think that it would be more goodness, truth, and beauty. But, you know, that's the one that's really, you know, stumps me sometimes. I mean, it's more obvious with thought, word, and deed, right? And with other triads, but that one, the beauty, truth, and goodness one. But Marvin quoted earlier a little preview that we're going to have. He quoted from the section we're going to be reading about, you know, truth is equally good and beauty, you know, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. that they're all tied together. So
right.
I don't imagine we have to untangle them. They're still all good.
Yeah, well, as long as we cultivate sensitivity.
Right.
Recognize those qualities and try to create them. I mean, that's, you know, it's called sons of God, you know, whether male or female, you know, in your answer book terms. That's sort of, we have sort of the creator responsibility, whereas the ministering spirit coming down from the mother and the infinite spirit is sort of more the ministering responsibility. So if we look at ourselves kind of that way, that we're sort of tasked with being creative, then these qualities are a great guide to what we might want to create. You know, you can be a truth worker, you can be a beauty worker, a goodness worker, or all three combined, and focus on that. And that's what's kind of cool about it. It's doable. These values
right.
can be manifested. You can bring more of them into reality, you know, which our planet so desperately needs. So we can kind of serve that way, you know, on the sort of meta level or higher level. Yeah, I'm going to bring more goodness into the world, you know, more truth, more beauty.
Right.
And that makes it all kind of coherent and straightforward, you think of it in those terms. But then, of course, you got to map that into some actual thing, but still, it's a good way to start.
Yeah, I think I do that just because I want to understand their functions, and it helps me, you know? It helps me understand who they are and how they function together, and I love that, you know? And someone once said, it's not really one, it's three. Three are the pillars of reality, and certainly goodness, beauty, and truth are those three primary values we're all craving and searching for.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, even create, you know, potential to create those values in a sense.
Right.
Well, you know, that
you know
that
so what's interesting
about,
here is how they've teased out divine truth and beauty for this next section after having
mm-hmm.
covered. Started off with love, you know, a couple of weeks ago, and then gone through goodness, the goodness of God, and pulled that out. It's very interesting that they've separated this out, and I'm not exactly sure why they've done it, because I haven't looked at this recently in depth. But, you know, why don't we go ahead and jump in? And we'll have more to inform our discussion.
Well, this
well,
is
you know,
a long section, too. Go ahead, Marvin.
Well, I was going to say, sort of in association with what you just mentioned, Andre, maybe before we read it, it's always also interesting for me to take a look at the structure of a whole paper, you know, and,
mm-hmm.
and to look at the way they've approached and the sequence and why it flows the way it does and the relationship of the sections to each other. So, you know, the title of this paper is The Nature of God, which is a huge mm-hmm. subject. And they start off with the infinity of God and then move to the Father's eternal perfection. So they're going somewhere. There's a sequence here. And then they move to justice and righteousness and mercy. And then the love of God. And then they move to this, what we consider those three primary values, and they start off with goodness, and they end up with divine truth and beauty at the end of the paper. And I was trying to sort of get a feel for why they moved in that kind of a sequence. And I don't know, but it feels a little hourglass to me.
Like, yeah.
They move into a center that focuses around love and then move back out. But other than that, I can't get much of a read on it. But it has an interesting feel to it. And that sort of was related to what you were alluding to, I think, Andre. So that was the only thing that I wondered
yeah.
about preliminary to reading this section. I wondered if you all had any reactions or thoughts to that.
Maybe the insight will come after the final section.
Well, that's true. Maybe. And I was going to say that it's 12 paragraphs, so we can divide it up in two readings, I think, if you guys want to.
Mm-hmm.
You can stop after the first
Fine
six.
Fine with me.
Okay, well, I'll take the first six, and then someone else
Sounds
can take
good.
The second six. So here we go. This is Paper 2, The Nature of God, Section 7, Divine Truth and Beauty. All finite knowledge and creature understanding are relative. Information and intelligence gleaned from even high sources is only relatively complete, locally accurate, and personally true. Physical facts are fairly uniform, but truth is a living and flexible factor in the philosophy of the universe. Evolving personalities are only partially wise and relatively true in their communications. They can be certain only as far as their personal experience extends. That which apparently may be wholly true in one place may be only relatively true in another segment of creation. Divine truth, final truth, is uniform and universal. But the story of things spiritual, as it is told by numerous individuals hailing from various spheres, may sometimes vary in details owing to this relativity in the completeness of knowledge and in the repleteness of personal experience, as well as in the length and extent of that experience. While the laws and decrees, the thoughts and attitudes of the first great source and center are eternally, infinitely, and universally true, at the same time, their application to and adjustment for every universe, system, world, and created intelligence are in accordance with the plans and technique of the Creator's sons as they function in their respective universes, as well as in harmony with the local plans and procedures of the Infinite Spirit and of all other associated celestial personalities. The false science of materialism would sentence mortal man to become an outcast in the universe. Such partial knowledge is potentially evil. It is knowledge composed of both good and evil. Truth is beautiful because it is both replete and symmetrical. When man searches for truth, he pursues the divinely real. Philosophers commit their gravest error when they are misled into the fallacy of abstraction, the practice of focusing the attention upon one aspect of reality, and then of pronouncing such an isolated aspect to be the whole truth. The wise philosopher will always look for the creative design which is behind and preexistent to all universe phenomena. The creative thought invariably precedes creative action. Intellectual self-consciousness can discover the beauty of truth, its spiritual quality, not only by the philosophic consistency of its concepts, but more certainly and surely by the unerring response of the ever-present spirit of truth. Happiness ensues from the recognition of truth because it can be acted out. It can be lived. Disappointment and sorrow attend upon error because, not being a reality, it cannot be realized in experience. Divine truth is best known by its spiritual flavor. Okay, so that's the first six. That's some
pretty good stuff. Yeah, wonderful. Thanks, Paula.
Do you want to discuss that and then move on to the next six or keep going?
Either way, but, you know, what's interesting there, that I think that's one of the, that last paragraph is one of the truly remarkable apply this to life kinds of statements, getting us to think clearly about happiness, about, but not just happiness, but the nature of truth as something livable, as not something just limited to factuality. What it's related to is livability. So when you can actually live out something like, for instance, the value of loving someone or the value of serving somebody, and you see and you feel and you know the realities that are associated with that, there is value to that experience. You generally, even if it's a difficult kind of service, there's a satisfaction that occurs throughout it. That there's happiness that ensues from knowing that you've put in your best effort at service. And the idea of disappointment and sorrow attend upon error, that kind of thing is, you know, when you know you've been lied to, which again can be on the level of factuality, but unfortunately there are lies on the level of trying to get people to live out realities that don't exist. You know, we're experiencing a great deal of that in our world today, where we are being, you know, told things that supposedly are factual, you know, about others particularly, that aren't true. You know, for instance, why there are a particular political camp that is doing X, Y, or Z. And instead of actually getting to know people, we're being encouraged to stereotype as a means of someone, usually someone trying to gain power over others, trying to control a narrative, trying to achieve an objective at the expense of other people's happiness. So, I mean, that's at least some of what's going on there. When they say divine truth is best known by its spiritual flavor, I think that's really, you know, a very internal and personal experience. One of the great things about what we get to experience in the Urantia movement is that when we're meeting each other and talking with each other and fellowshipping with each other, to one extent or another, we've been trying to live these things. And when we get together with others, we get to experience at least one salient aspect of this. And that is that we don't have to build up quite so far in order to have an interaction or have a relationship with a person, because some of the foundation we can already see is there for the relationship. there's a recognition, for instance, of brotherhood or siblinghood, or, you know, whether it's brotherhood or sisterhood, or just in the generic sense, siblinghood, we get to experience some of that, the wonder of that interaction. And it builds, you know, what we get to experience with each other. Those of us who've known each other for a good long period of time, we begin to understand that there is a pretty steady foundation of, for lack of a better term, truth, of livable reality that people have gone through that we can kind of count on and realize, you know, this person, when they interact with me, are largely coming from a place of love, as opposed to, let's say, coming from a place of centripetality. That's a word that is sort of like out of the Urantia book when they talk about centripetal realities. I think they're really just talking about people that are self-centered. You know, people that keep referencing things back to a center that they know about that is close to themselves.
Right.
And we don't have to be that way with each other. The best relationships we have are with people that are generous with us and don't have to constantly be bringing things back to reference themselves.
Hmm.
There's love there.
Well, I'm glad you offered that example. Because, you know, my mind always wants to look for an example. I know this is true. I know what they're saying in that last paragraph is absolutely true. But my mind is searching for an example of that in life, you know, an example of truth that can be lived out, acted out, they say, acted out. And as in distinction to error that can't be realized or experienced because it's not real. And my mind goes blank. I don't know why that happens. It should be easy. And you offered service. That's a really good one. That's a really good example of a truth that can be acted out. I don't know that the truth, you know, is the truth service? I don't know. What I'm looking for is, you know, God is love, okay. And if God is love, you know, all men and women are your brothers and sisters. Okay, that's true. I believe that. So I can act on that. I can act that out by being kind to everyone I meet. For whatever reason, to lead with kindness, to try to lead with understanding and patience so that I can get to know that person and understand their motives and sentiments and perhaps learn to love that person, learn to fall in love with that person. And I can act that out. Those are all truths from the Urantia book, right? If I get to know somebody, I can learn to fall in love with them. That's true, I think. That is true in my experience. I have experienced that. I've experienced people that I've met that I didn't immediately love, but once I got to know them, I loved them dearly. So I have acted that out, and the act was the patience it took to get to know them, the effort it took to get to know them.
Yeah.
And it was worthwhile. And when you look back in retrospect on that relationship and you go, wow, what if I had never given that person a chance? I'd be far more poor spiritually. And I'm far richer because I acted on that truth that when you get to know somebody, you will eventually fall in love with them. I acted on that. I took them at their word. Because I recognized the truth of it in my own experience. So I guess that's an example for me, you know, and it takes some thought maybe or even discussion to tease some of those out.
Yeah.
But
well,
there's so many.
There's some interesting clues here, I think, to what you're talking about. I just noticed something about the sequence of paragraphs. I've recently been very interested in principles, you know, and the Orange Book presents principles, you know, because principles are something you can kind of live by, which is kind of what you're talking about, Paula. And I noticed in this sequence of paragraphs, in paragraph 4 through 8, every one of them includes a very concisely stated principle. So in 4, 5, and 6, it comes in as the last line of each one of those paragraphs. And then in 7 and 8, it's the first line of those two paragraphs.
If I
just read those in sequence,
yeah,
I think maybe I'll get a sense of what I'm talking about.
Okay.
So in paragraph 4, they conclude by saying, when man searches for truth, he pursues the divinely real.
Mm.
Okay, so this is like suggesting, okay, we're going to get ourselves into action here. We're going to search for truth, you know, and pursue the divinely real, creative undertaking. And then the last line of the next paragraph says, the creator thought invariably precedes creative action. So that's kind of expanding on that or reflecting on that in a way. When I say creator thought, I'm not thinking about God so much. I mean, obviously God too, but I'm thinking more about us. You know, when we attempt to create, our thought as the creator invariably precedes creative action. Okay, so keep that in mind. So like what you were describing, Paul, about how to regard someone who maybe you weren't so attracted to in the beginning, but you had the thought that maybe you can create a relationship here. Let's, you know, and that thought preceded your action, right, in a sense.
Right, right.
And then the next paragraph ends by saying divine truth is best known by its spiritual flavor. So this is suggesting that somehow we can sense the quality, the attractive quality of divine truth. And then the next two paragraphs, the first line of paragraph 7 is the eternal quest is for unification, for divine coherence. And then the next paragraph starts by saying the discernment of supreme beauty is the discovery and integration of reality.
Mm-hmm.
So each one of those is a principle, you know, that we can live by, in a sense. You know, like, okay, I'm on an eternal quest for unification, and I understand that as divine coherence. And if I can discern supreme beauty, I'm discovering the integration of reality, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that thought precedes action, and that searching for truth is searching for the divine reality. Anyway, I just love how all five of those kind of present an actionable framework for engagement with reality.
An actionable truth, right?
Yeah, an actionable, yeah, right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Set of principles.
You know,
and
always,
if you can stay true to all five of those, you're going to be, you know, you're going to be finding what's real. You're going to be creating what's good, you know. You're going to discover coherence and integration of reality. So
it's so beautiful, Chuck. You know, and when I think of, you know, the creator thought invariably precedes a creative action, you know, one of my favorite triads is thought, word, and deed, simply because the Father thought it, the Son spoke it, and the conjoint actor made it happen, right? And we're like that. Our process starts with a thought. You're right. It starts with what we're thinking. Our thoughts are what's leading us Godward, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what we're thinking about, or not Godward, in some other place, that other place is. It starts with our thought, though. And then we speak it. If we think it and then speak it, now we're two-thirds of the way there to actually consecrating it by doing it. So it's you know, you can think it, and then you can just let it go, I guess. But if you think it and then speak it, put word on it, now you've gone the next step to consecrating that, and then by actually doing it, now you've consecrated that thought. You've actually made that thought an action.
Mm-hmm.
And I always think that occurs to me,
yeah,
you know, that it's especially important when you have a negative thought, I think, or a thought against somebody. Mm-hmm. And you can control, and that's why we need a thought controller, right? Or a thought adjuster, which becomes a thought controller.
Which is our evaluation source. That's how we evaluate.
Right.
So you could ask,
so it's right there.
Does that thought have spiritual flavor?
Right.
Is it an angry thought or a destructive thought? Or
a revengeful thought?
Revengeful thought. Those do not have spiritual flavor. So that's a good way to test those thoughts before you put them into action. And then the test is whether it brings unification, if it adds to the coherence of reality. And then finally, you can see in that the potential for integration, and that's a beautiful thing. Supreme beauty.
And, and those beautiful truths acted out bring about goodness.
Right.
Themselves bring about more truth, beauty, and goodness because they've been acted out now so that they become potentially exponential in their creation of more of the same.
Right.
Why it's so important to speak truth. Not just truth that makes heat, but truth that can light. Truth that creates light.
Truth that has spiritual flavor.
That has spiritual flavor, which I was going to ask you guys, what do you think they mean by that? What does spiritual flavor mean to you? Well, that it gives light is what would be one good way to describe it. But, go ahead, Chuck. What do you think?
No, I was just going to say, I think you know it when you see it.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's best known by its spiritual flavor.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Marvin.
You were talking, Paula, about trying to find an experience that is the living out, that is the embodiment of some of what we're talking about here. And as I was looking at that paragraph number 6, which is the last one you read, it struck me when they said, but more certainly and surely by the unerring response of the ever-present spirit of truth.
Mm-hmm.
And what struck me is that, the spirit of truth is Jesus present with us.
Mm-hmm.
And his life is the actual living out, the actual embodiment of these realities kind of in the round, in a living expression. And they end that paragraph by saying divine truth is best known by its spiritual flavor. And the experience, as you were casting about for an experience, Paul, the experience that occurred to me was, and it's mainly because in a study group I participate in, we were just spending some time with this episode, was Wednesday, the rest day, when Jesus makes the choice, the young lad grasps hold of the basket, John Mark, and won't
John
let
Mark.
Go. Jesus makes the choice to just spend the day with him, which to me is a living embodiment of the primacy of the Father's love. Jesus was going to go off and spend time trying to prepare for what was awaiting him. And in that moment, he chose to prioritize this relationship with John Mark. And he spent the whole day with him. And that's what he did in preparation for his great test, his great trial. And somehow for me, that epitomizes a living embodiment of what we're speaking about here, that truth gets lived out. It can be lived. And I think that day was a triumph of truth and prioritization. Anyways, that's what was occurring to me, and it's in appreciating that and what happened during that day that last statement in the paragraph makes sense. Divine truth is best known by its spiritual flavor, and so for me, the Master's presence and the presence of the Spirit of Truth guiding us will always show us the way that truth and beauty and goodness can be best lived out in the moment. And it's a living unfolding reality. It's not something we can figure out simply intellectually. It's inspiration, it's revelation from the Master with us and from the indwelling Spirit of the Father with us and the ministry of the Holy Spirit all operating in us. It's a living, unfolding experience of discovery in the moment. So those are just some of the thoughts that were occurring to me.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, and then if you look at the role that John Mark played in the following days, you know, that was also very significant. So that time that Jesus spent with John Mark, that added bonding and connection between the two of them, part of what, you know, roused or inspired this loyalty on the part of John Mark and how he just like had to be there and he was followed along. He was watching what was happening. You know, anyway, it's cute. I don't know if cute's the right word, but it's interesting to see it also in that perspective. You know, how that time he spent with Jesus that afternoon at what was the height of the, you know, that's the time when you least expect, like you're saying, Jesus to spend his whole day, you know, with a youngster like John Mark. But yet that ended up being very, very important. I mean, the truth and the beauty of that giving, that giving spirit on Jesus' part. Okay, I'm just going to give myself to John Mark today. But then the fruit that came from that was also very significant as events played out over the next period.
That's such a great story to bring up. You know, there's something about, you know, when you were speaking, it made me realize that Jesus' words, you could say Jesus' words are best known by their spiritual flavor. You know, you could easily say that. And it's that has made them last through all the centuries, which makes me realize that people don't always live out truth. They don't. They might even say they believe it, necessarily live it out. They can live it out. They should live it out. But they don't always. And that's, you know, and that's what, that's kind of the crux. It's the cognitive dissonance that, you know, humans experience when they know better, they know a higher truth, but they don't live it. They refuse to, you know, act it out.
Mm-hmm.
Which is probably the reason why, you know, we get into so much evil and error and even sin on this planet because we refuse to act on our highest understanding of truth.
Mm-hmm.
Even just that, even just on our highest understanding, like throughout all of the great religions, there is some version of the golden rule. But and even in our country, you know that our founding fathers held largely to these wonderful principles. They have not been acted out, which is what is the constant effort that we put forward to get ourselves and to get our elected officials or whomever they are to act out these truths. We hold these truths to be self-evident, right? They're speaking about truths that they believe are divine. They're self-evident. And so, you know, our struggle, I think, as a group of humans is to not only find these truths, and we do already have many in abundance, but to actually live them out, because they can be lived out if only we would give it a shot, if only we would try it, you know, and not fall back into our doubting or our, you know, the fall back into error where someone is, error cannot be realized and experienced. So, you know, and sometimes it may take generations, hundreds of years, thousands of years to weed out an error that's been being perpetrated on mankind for a long time, and we know that's true. It has been, and we're still caught in it, you know? But if we would live out the divine truth, especially the ones that Jesus gave us, we could start with that and act those out. Boy, things would probably start to change pretty quickly.
Well, this point, you know? I don't know. This is a story about John Marcus, so it's kind of compelling. Just one line here is so poignant. This is like when, you know, Jesus is waiting for the soldiers or whoever to come and arrest him. And he decided to go off some distance from the camp to await that happening so that the apostles and the Greeks and everybody wouldn't be unduly aroused.
Have to witness it, yeah.
Yeah, and that section concludes with this one short line where it says, Jesus sat down alone on the olive press where he awaited the coming of the betrayer. And he was seen at this time only by John Mark and an innumerable host of celestial observers.
John Mark was able to fly under the radar, wasn't he?
Well, they almost caught him, you know. They pulled out his coat. He had to run naked through the woods or whatever.
What a hero John Mark is. It reminds me. I'll share a little story with you guys. One of the first jobs I ever got, I was a wrangler at a stable for 4 years, from the time I was 12 till I was 16. And those were very formidable years, and I absolutely love horses, and I would not give up one moment of that job ever. But here I was, a 12-year-old, walking out into the corral every day. We had to catch 50 head of horses and get them all saddled up and get them ready for the day's work. And then at the end of the day, we'd lead them all out to pasture and let them go, and they'd kick up their heels. So it was a 12-hour day, and I did it all summer from April to September every year for 4 years. Seven 12-hour days in a row, you know, because we were open from Monday through Friday. But anyway, I was a newcomer in the group, and we were in the process of catching all of the horses. And I overheard my boss, Bertha. Her name was Bertha LaGrosse. The stable had been in her family in Colorado for 100 years. Many of the head there were born there, multiple generations of horses in this stable. I heard her say, she handed me a bridle and she said, Paula, go catch Fury. So I headed out to catch Fury and caught him and brought him back to the hitching post and tied him up and got ready to get his saddle. And as I was walking past her, she was standing there with her husband, Fred, and I heard her say, I think Paula can catch Fury because she doesn't know he's hard to catch. And that, you know, in a way, it's that innocence of John Mark, you know, that was able to so compel the master to say, no, hold on to the basket. Because he didn't know that he probably shouldn't or couldn't or whatever. He just knew that he wanted to spend this day with his Lord and Master. He wanted to spend this day. And there's a great spiritual lesson there for all of us. Sometimes we stop ourselves from the best possible things just by thinking we know better or we shouldn't, you know. We prevent ourselves from doing something. And, you know, the story of this, of catching Fury, it wasn't until that moment when Bertha said that the spell was broken. I couldn't catch him after that.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And what I didn't realize was that every day when they would go out and catch all the horses, it would take four of us to catch Fury because we had to back him in a corner. He was a big horse. And everybody had to, you know, work together to get this horse caught. But I was able to catch him because I didn't know he was hard to catch. And whatever changes that brought about in both Fury and me, I don't know. After I knew that he was hard to catch, I couldn't catch him anymore. And it took four of us again. But there's something beautiful about innocence in that way.
Yeah, I think, interesting story.
You know, the innocence of John Mark, just holding on to the basket. And all of the apostles saying, gosh, I wish I had done that. I wish I thought of that. You know, that's why it's so beautiful, I think.
Yeah, we all
imagine we're John Mark and we get to spend a day alone in the hills with God. That story is so endearing. Most readers would tell you it's one of their very favorites.
Yeah. And then John Mark wouldn't let Jesus out of his sight after that.
He wouldn't. And he was so important, as you point out, Chuck, in that. So that is definitely a truth that was acted out. The truth of his love and his desire to be with the Master.
Mm-hmm.
And he acted it out, you know, because the Master was truth. I love that quote that says he was truth for that generation. He is truth. That's why his spirit of truth is so invaluable. And, you know, somebody had mentioned that, the spirit of truth. I can't remember which one of you guys mentioned that, but I don't know if, you know, to me, that is an unmistakable feeling when truth resonates with your heart. It's just unmistakable when the spirit bears witness with your spirit. And that has been my experience with the Urantia book from the moment I picked it up. You know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's powerful stuff. And the more you hear, the more you feel that resonance of spirit, the more you understand how that feels then. And you can check in with that. Someone's telling you something that, and they claim that it's true, you can check that internally. Is that true?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Well, at least to the extent that you've lived those kinds of truths yourself, and at least to the extent where you're in greater attunement with, you know, your thought adjuster, the spirit of truth, or I mean, there's no second guessing that. There's no saying, well, am I in tune with my thought adjuster or spirit of truth? You know, that's not the issue. It really does come down to, you know, a clear internal experience that you're not second guessing all the time. And it only comes through experience, really. You know, it's possible to, for many of us, you know, to be fooled by things we haven't encountered before. And, you know, that's one of the, I think, stories of the evolution of mankind. You know, that here you have all kinds of things that happen either for the first time or they happen in such a way that many people haven't seen it happen that way before. And so they're duped by it.
Mm-hmm.
And they follow along for a while. We learn in the Urantia papers that this was true even of lower celestial intelligences in
like
the Lucifer Rebellion.
Like
Adam and Eve, and like particularly you think about the angels in heaven, you don't put them in that category. You don't put the celestial beings, even the lower ones, you know, in a category of they could be fooled by an elaborate lie. And it's not so much, again, about an intellectual or a factual lie. It's about if you've had the experience of living through something, then it's much more recognizable to you when something isn't true. You know, for instance, people that have been lied to a lot and have figured that out, you know, and understood, seen the outworking of that, there's something recognizable to them about when they're being lied to. It's not necessarily what is being said to them. Maybe there's something about how it's being said. Maybe there's something about context or whatever. But for instance, you know, I worked in, I hesitate to state this, but it's true. I worked in both consumer and commercial collections for a while where, people owed money, and it was my job to call and remind them and ask them. And I never had to be, you know, a hard guy about it. I had to call them and ask for money and try to determine in some cases whether or not there was any real intention to pay when there was a track record of not paying.
Mm-hmm.
Point is that you're lied to a lot in that job. People tell you a lot of different stories.
Yeah.
And after a while, you can really begin to tease out who's being sincere with you and who's really lying to you. And there were, some people that just assumed that everybody was a liar, you know, in the job or whatever. But
right.
There was an opportunity there to, if you had the ability to, you know, have some compassion for the people, because, you know, not everybody is not paying because, you know, they're completely disrespectful of the financial order or capitalism or, you know, fill in your blank for what you would do to categorize people like that. There are many, many people that are just really in dire straits. They've lost a job. They've lost a husband. They've got all kinds of things going on. And the key there is, are you willing to listen? Are you willing to pay attention to what people are saying to you? And you still have to achieve an end. You still have to get to some place, but there may be some leeway about how you can do that if you are acting.
If you really want to help.
Yeah, if you're paying attention, let's just say it that way. You're paying attention and you're applying what is available there in our human faculties to work with other people. And but all of these kinds of things, you know, you get certain cultures on Earth where they're not as easily fooled as, for instance, many people in our culture are. And why is that? Well, they've been lied to a lot. So they have a lot of different approaches to what is being told them or what they're being shown. And I'll just share one other thing. You know, I had the most profound experience about my own ability to be fooled and learning something about myself when I was, probably back in the early 90s. And I was still in teaching and, you know, looking for ways to make more money, and had met somebody from, you know, one of the multi-level marketing schemes. Don't have to mention which one it was. It was one of the big ones, you know.
There were so many.
And there were so many, but this was the one that had been around for a long time and had been there, and many different people at different levels. And this woman said, you know, I want you to meet this guy. He's from Colorado Springs. He's a double diamond, you know? And I thought, wow, okay, great, fine. Let me meet him. You know, I have my skepticism or whatever, but so he met me for, you know, a cup of tea or coffee or whatever it was, you know, at a Village Inn over at Hamden and I-25. I still remember where we met. It was just a little ways from my work on my lunch hour. And we talked, and this man was smooth and believable. And, you know, he drove this black Cadillac with gold trim And not that I was particularly impressed by it, but I remember those features, right?
Mm-hmm.
And was talking, and you know, I was I was getting interested in what he was saying. I was becoming interested in being able to, you know, perhaps get involved with this because of all the things that he was saying about how it worked and how a lot of the people that were involved had high values and on and on and on and on. And as I left and I was driving back to work, driving back to, you know, teach a class, and I, it was about 15 minutes in, and all of a sudden I realized something. We had had just, he'd had like a cup of coffee or a tea, and me too. And I realized the man didn't leave even a 15% tip on something that was like a $2.50 bill. And I thought, wow, he left literally no tip. And I thought, if that's how I have to become in order to get in this, and if that's what this man has turned into, and what I realized there, I realized I could be fooled through my ears, but not through my eyes. And paid attention to that. And you know, when you learn a salient truth about yourself that way, and you realize, for instance, what is a limitation I have, and what is something that I have that might overcome that limitation, those are important junctures in our, you know, moving forward together. So, you know, with our brothers and sisters on earth, we have to learn how to deal with various situations. And I didn't go forward with that opportunity in air quotes, so-called.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, this man was a double diamond and he couldn't leave a 50 cent tip. And I called the person after. I said, I can't go forward with this. Do you realize that? I don't want to become that kind of a person. And that was it. That was it for me. And that was it for me with MLMs and anything like that at that point. But the point is that we all have experiences like that or similar to that or with different things that become important parts of our retinue of experiences. And the reason I bring it up in this context is, you know, we have to ask ourselves, why are we put into an animal body in the first place? Why are we started from such imperfection? There must be some kinds of traits that they would like to see spiritualized and carried forward that could never appear on Paradise or Havona or even on any of the lower, you know, architectural spheres without there being, having to wrangle with such low-level phenomena as people that are effectively lying to you, you know, and how do you deal with that? How do you ferret that out? How do you navigate it? The Supreme Being needs to cope with that. The Supreme Being needs to, in order to achieve a perfected state of the grand universe, will need to cope with those kinds of realities. And that means each one of us getting a little bit better with our little piece of reality, becoming a little bit more adept with truth over falsehood, beauty over ugliness, goodness over evil, love over whatever its absence manifests as.
Right. Right. Well, thanks, Andre. That, you know, that reminds me, I mean, when you're thinking about the spirit of truth, one of my favorite quotes, and one of the most beautiful thing about Part 4 about the whole Urantia book is that it really introduces you to Jesus. And now that you know him well, you really can recognize the spirit of truth. You really start to resonate more with it. The more truth you know, the more substance is there for it to react to and work with, right? And there's this quote from the Mother Spirit paper, from paper 34, that speaks of, you know, and she made it possible for him to pour out that whole, that spirit of truth on all flesh, and which is why they're bringing it up in this paper. But it says, though the spirit of truth is poured out upon all flesh, this spirit of the Son is almost wholly limited in function and power by man's personal reception of that which constitutes the sum and substance of the mission of the bestowal Son. The Holy Spirit is partly independent of human attitude and partially conditioned by the decisions and cooperation of the will of man. Nevertheless, the ministry of the Holy Spirit becomes increasingly effective in the sanctification and spiritualization of the inner life of those mortals who are more fully, who the more fully obey the divine leadings. The reason that I like that paragraph so much is, I think, well, because I've read this book, because you've read it, because we have, we really do understand the Son's, the sum and substance of his mission. Not only do we have his whole life and teachings, but we have him before, during, and after, the sum and substance of his whole bestowal, of all seven of his bestowals. We really do resonate more with the spirit of truth because we have experienced truth through this book. And it's given us an ability that many, you know, to discern the truth that many on this world don't have. You know, well, not to its full function and power.
Gives us a big dose of this flavor they're talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
The rest
yeah.
of the book's full of this spiritual flavor. And I think that's how all of us probably, when we started reading it, we just somehow felt that or just knew that intuitively or something and said, oh, wow, I got to keep reading this, you know, because there's this attraction, this drawing power that there's yeah. that follows from that spiritual flavor. And, you know, having experienced such a big dose of it, you might say, through the Urantia book, then that kind of tunes us a little bit so we're more able to see its presence or absence in
right.
other circumstances. So that's I kind of never thought about that before, but that's kind of one of the side benefits of studying the Urantia book. You become familiar with the spiritual flavor of truth, and that makes it, you know, it can help us be more discerning.
Yeah, exactly.
Trying to educate our palate.
Oh, you're right. Exactly.
Right. And it's why it's so, for me, it's so important to get it out there so that that truth can benefit others. You know,
if they see it and find it, yeah.
Yeah, if they see it. But I think what, you know, you said you look for it, and I think that has a lot to do with it. Seeking has a lot to do with your ability to be open to finding.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm. That urge.
I mean, yeah, if you're seeking, then you're looking. Right. So, well,
I think one of the perspectives that comes from the UB, but I think they challenge us in a huge way. They give us so much perspective and so much information and such high ideals and replete under, you know, explanation of those ideals and what we're here to do. That one thing that to me is really critical and comforting is the idea that we have all of eternity to live these realities out. And
that's
and,
true.
You know, and to be patient with ourselves in our ability to you know, to take these ideals and run with them really fully.
That's such a good
point. So that,
point,
you know, man. Yeah, when Jesus is given to us as this example and this ideal of living the spiritual truth in a beautiful and a good way, you know, we have a sense of proportionality as to where we are in that journey, and that we have all of eternity with Jesus and with our Mother Spirit to, you know, and with the Father to pursue the great goals, the high ideals that they give us. And that's, to me, that's really critical to keep it in proportion.
Establishes a standard that we can aspire to.
Right. And have the patience to know that it's not an easy thing. It's a lifelong, eternal occupation beyond just this life. It keeps going. We're seeking and finding all the way. And delighting in that personal discovery of truth, personally discovered truth, which is, you know, one of the more joyful things I've ever experienced.
Yeah, it's like it rescues us from the sea of relativity.
Right.
Yeah, which is, if you don't have a concept of absoluteness or, you know, the divine origination of things, at the center of reality, it's easy to think, oh, well, it doesn't really matter, whatever, you know, the sort of whatever, it's all relative attitude, which I remember hearing a lot when I was younger.
Me too.
And you just wander in that sea of one thing being relative to the next, but there's no higher standard to use as an evaluation, you know, method. So the
who knows what's true?
Gives,
you
right,
heard that
right.
a lot, I bet. Who knows what's
well,
true?
Well, who was it said truth? What is truth? Was that Herod or was that? I think that was Herod, wasn't it?
Truth, what is truth? And it is relative. I mean, they
I'm
did describe
truth.
That, too.
I'm standing right in front of you.
Right.
Anyway.
Well, shall we continue on with 7? Who would like to start up with reading paragraph 7 and go the rest of the 6 paragraphs in this section? Marvin, do you want to?
Take it.
Okay,
yeah,
cool.
I can go ahead and take it. It's interesting to me that the next paragraph begins with a statement, the eternal quest is for unification, for divine coherence, that it's an eternal process that we've begun here.
Yeah.
The far-flung physical universe coheres in the Isle of Paradise. The intellectual universe coheres in the God of Mind, the conjoint actor. The spiritual universe is coherent in the personality of the eternal Son. Now that's interesting, given our conversation about Jesus. But the isolated mortal of time and space coheres in God the Father. I'm sorry, I'm being struck by this. You know, we are the isolated mortals of time and space. Coheres in God the Father through the direct relationship between the indwelling thought adjuster and the universal Father. Man's adjuster is a fragment of God and everlastingly seeks for divine unification. It coheres with and in the paradise deity of the first source and center. The discernment of supreme beauty is the discovery and integration of reality. The discernment of the divine goodness in the eternal truth, that is ultimate beauty. Even the charm of human art consists in the harmony of its unity. The great mistake of the Hebrew religion was its failure to associate the goodness of God and the factual truths of science and the appealing beauty of art. As civilization progressed, and since religion continued to pursue the same unwise course of overemphasizing the goodness of God to the relative exclusion of truth and neglect of beauty, there developed an increasing tendency for certain types of men to turn away from the abstract and dissociated concept of isolated goodness. The overstressed and isolated morality of modern religion, which fails to hold the devotion and loyalty of many 20th century men, would rehabilitate itself if, in addition to its moral mandates, it would give equal consideration to the truths of science, philosophy, and spiritual experience. And to the beauties of the physical creation
the charm of intellectual art and the grandeur of genuine character achievement.
Hmm.
Man, you could do whole college courses on that paragraph.
That one, yeah.
The religious challenge of this age is to those far-seeing and forward-looking men and women of spiritual insight who will dare to construct a new and appealing philosophy of living out of the enlarged and exquisitely integrated modern concepts of cosmic truth, universe beauty, and divine goodness. Such a new and righteous vision of morality will attract all that is good in the mind of man and challenge that which is best in the human soul. Truth, beauty, and goodness are divine realities. And as man ascends the scale of spiritual living, these supreme qualities of the eternal become increasingly coordinated and unified in God, who is love. All truth, material, philosophic, or spiritual, is both beautiful and good. All real beauty, material art, or spiritual symmetry, is both true and good. All genuine goodness, whether personal morality, social equity, or divine ministry, is equally true and beautiful. Health, sanity, and happiness are integrations of truth, beauty, and goodness as they are blended in human experience. Such levels of efficient living come about through the unification of energy systems, idea systems, and spirit systems. Truth is coherent, beauty attractive, goodness stabilizing. And when these values of that which is real are coordinated in personality experience, the result is a high order of love conditioned by wisdom and qualified by loyalty. The real purpose of all universe education is to effect the better coordination of the isolated child of the worlds with the larger realities of his expanding experience.
Mm-hmm.
I'll read that one again. The real purpose of all universe education is to effect the better coordination of the isolated child of the worlds with the larger realities of his expanding experience. Reality is finite on the human level, infinite and eternal on the higher and divine levels.
Oh.
And that's the end of that paper, and it's presented by a divine counselor acting by authority of the Ancients of Days on Yversa.
Oh. Hmm. That's another section that is just, you know, I hear it quoted so often. It's just so foundational.
Which one's that?
This section we just read, section 7.
Oh, this section, yeah. I often feel when I read passages like these that I'm barely hanging on to one sentence before I go on to the next one, and then when I go on to the next one, I sort of lose it. But I'm left with an overall impression to reading it of something. And what is very profound for me is this sense of, you know, they're giving me a foretaste of things that it will take me an eternity of living to really, in any sense, experientialize or get a hold of and understand through my experience.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's big, big vistas of potential suggested here. We can only kind of get a sense of. But one of the places where they do that is in that first paragraph, Marvin, where you kind of stopped and paused over this statement that the isolated mortal of time and space coheres in God the Father through the direct relationship between the adjuster and the universal Father. I've never really thought before about the relationship between the adjuster and the Father. I thought they were sort of the same thing. But the thought adjuster, of course, is fragmentized entity, you know, block of sort of the universal Father. But the, we thought, how do they say it? Coheres? I said moral time space, coheres in God the Father. Okay, I got that. But through the direct relationship between the indwelling thought adjuster and the universal Father. So we kind of participate. The adjuster enables us to have a relationship with the Father, I think is what maybe what that's saying. And it's in that relationship that we become coherent.
Yeah, I think it's the word coheres that you know, strikes me. And I think, okay, coheres to what? You know?
So the next sentence.
Go ahead.
You know, I looked up the definition of the word cohere.
Me too.
It's good. It says to be united, to form a whole.
Mm-hmm.
Which is really interesting.
We cohere. We form a whole then. But the isolated mortal of time and space forms a whole in God, becomes one with God, in other words.
The adjuster and the original first source and center, the Father, the Creator personality, become more whole in this process and our participation in it. And we also become more whole with them.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and the paragraph
and more whole with everything else.
Yeah, the paragraph begins with this sentence: "The eternal quest is for unification, comma for divine coherence."
Okay, so cohering with divinity.
Yeah, becoming whole with divinity.
Yeah,
and
right.
And unification, and that it's an eternal. It's an eternal process.
Yeah. We become more and more coherent, and if we're becoming more and more incoherent, that's not desirable. That's not the desirable result. But I thought it was interesting at the end of that paragraph too that it tells us man's adjuster is a fragment of God and everlastingly seeks for divine unification. So it's innate. He wants to rejoin. he wants to reunify. He's going to take us back, whether we, you know, willing or un. But much easier for him to lead us back willingly. But he's going back. He's going back to source.
Right. That sentence kind of explains a little bit about this relationship between the adjuster and the Father. I mean, just to read the whole sentence: man's adjuster is a fragment of God and everlastingly seeks for divine unification. And then they explain, speaking of our adjuster, that it coheres with and in the paradise deity of the first source and center. So there's a dynamic process going on there between the adjuster and the Father, the first source and center, and that's happening within us. And that we have the potential for becoming coherent in our association with that relationship.
The journey of the psychic circles, right? We're getting closer and closer to that. Yeah.
And the journey to paradise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's interesting in that paragraph they use the word cohere, the words cohere, coherent, and unification in every sentence multiple ways. I mean, that's the theme of the paragraph. Yeah, it's like 6 or 7 or 8 times they use the word cohere or coherent over and over.
They qualify truth, beauty, and goodness too in this section, you know, like they give us terms like supreme truth, divine goodness, eternal truth, you know. ultimate beauty. So I guess, you know, they're calling us to understand the higher concepts of these things, truth, beauty, and goodness.
Mm-hmm. Well, they have universe repercussions,
yeah,
functions, but then they also have function individually, even in an isolated mortal such as ourselves, I guess relatively isolated.
I just had a funny thought, you know, just reflecting on all of what we've been talking about. And we were talking about cohering and unity. And the thought that occurred to me is the story you told, Paula, about you with the horse. What was the name? Fury?
Fury.
Yeah.
Big black
horse.
But in
a sense, yeah, in a sense, when you went out initially, you cohered with Fury.
Mm-hmm.
You became one with him because you weren't dealing with the fallacy of division or separateness.
Now we had no prejudice.
Yeah.
Right.
And so something in the horse sensed that in you and just allowed you to mm-hmm. to be one with him, and it was relatively effortless.
That's interesting, isn't it? It kind of tells
mm-hmm.
you what those lies and those half-truths about God have done to humanity to separate us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they touch on that too, you know. The great mistake of the Hebrew religion was its failure to associate the goodness of God with the factual truths of science and the appealing beauty of the heart. And, you know, it's interesting. You have just one part of the equation, but you end up missing these other very important pieces. And then they say the overstressed and isolated morality of modern religion, which fails to hold the devotion and loyalty of many 20th century men, would rehabilitate itself if, in addition to its moral mandates, it would give equal consideration to the truths of science, philosophy, and spiritual experience, and to the beauties of the physical creation, the charm of intellectual art, and the grandeur of genuine character achievement. That is just such an amazing, you know, statement to me.
Yeah, they're all statements of unification and coherence.
Yeah, that's true.
Versus splitting
they
up
are.
The division.
Yeah, well, the danger of religion becoming an abstract and dissociated concept, abstract and dissociated concept of isolated goodness.
Right.
Then it just becomes kind of a thing out there that you point to rather than it being a living reality in your life.
It's like that great statement they make, and I can't remember what paper it is, but law is life itself and not the rules of its conduct. You know, and that's one of those statements that make you scratch your head. You go, what? Okay, let me try to, you know, unpack that one. But it's the same thing. You know, you're missing the point. If you're overly focused on the rules, now you're locked in to a myopic point of view that won't allow you to see truth in anything else, or beauty in anything else, or goodness in anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, if it's eternal, then we really have to open ourselves up to it, because it'll come in from all different levels. It's like this, you know, the statement about spiritual experience. Wow. Okay. That one of the best things about having the discussion with people of faith is to hear their spiritual experiences. If you ask me, that's what I love the most. I want to hear about how they triumphed over the dark night of the soul. I want to hear that. That's interesting to me. Doesn't matter if it's the way I did it or not. And with every new experience that I learned, that some human achieved, you know, through experience, some new truth, some new beauty for their soul, some new acquirement of their reality. You know, that this experience took me to a deeper level, a more meaningful level, and I've never forgotten it my whole life. You know, when they tell me that, I'm all ears. I want to hear exactly what it was. And even if it's not my experience, you know, I would never discount it because it meant so much to them. And, you know, it's just fascinating that, you know, we, for whatever reason, sometimes we get locked into something and then we discount other things. And we see that a lot in religion. Religion becomes dogmatic. I think that's what we mean when we say, well, that's dogmatic. Dogmatic meaning you can't see anything but that. You know, you won't open yourself up to more.
Well, yeah,
more truth is coming in from different places.
Kind of becomes a thing.
Yeah.
You know, I noticed
it's almost
something.
Like,
yeah.
It's you just briefly, it's almost like dogmatic is the opposite of coherent.
Yeah, it's like forcing coherence. It's like hitting it with a hammer.
Yeah. It becomes so exclusive.
I think that the living situation of Jesus arrayed against the scribes and Pharisees, and how their whole religion was to break things apart and segmentalize it, and to the point where it just made no sense. And Jesus wanted to come and make things whole, coherent, in a much larger sense.
Yeah. I did notice something interesting. I don't know if it's going to be interesting for the rest of you, but in that, the language there in that paragraph where they say the tendency for certain types of men to turn away from the abstract and associated concept of isolated goodness, that very closely parallels what they say about the Trinity concept, where they say that given a sufficient time, philosophy tends to abstract the personal qualities of the deity concept of monotheism, thus reducing this idea of an unrelated God to the status of a pantheistic absolute. And they put that in the context of how that, you know, eventually lose touch with God as a result. They talk about the experiential protest against the impossibility of conceiving the oneness of a deanthropomorphized solitary deity of unrelated universe significance. So this idea of something becoming unrelated to universe significance is kind of what they're talking about in this other paragraph we were just reading, where if goodness is isolated from truth and beauty, it can likewise become a dissociated concept.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. There's kind of an interesting parallel there somewhere in that. Maybe what I'm feeling perhaps is that having the Trinity concept makes it easier to experience the balance of truth, beauty, and goodness. I don't know, something like that.
Okay. Yeah.
Well,
you know, a story about Jesus honoring the spiritual experience in someone else is the story of the young man, Gadaya, who, and this is from when he was in the Mediterranean, asked him about... because he was so well versed in Hebrew traditions, he pointed out to Jesus, he asked Jesus this question. But do you suppose, he was talking about Jonah and the whale, do you suppose the big fish really did swallow Jonah? And it says, Jesus perceived that this young man's life had been tremendously influenced by this tradition, and that its contemplation had impressed upon him the folly of trying to run away from duty. Jesus therefore said nothing that would suddenly destroy the foundations of Gaudiya's present motivation for practical living. In answering this question, Jesus said, "My friend, we are all Jonas with lives to live in accordance with the will of God. And at all times when we seek to escape the present duty of living by running away to far-off enticements, we thereby put ourselves in the immediate control of those influences which are not directed by the powers of truth and the forces of righteousness. The flight from duty is the sacrifice of truth. The escape from the service of light and life can only result in those distressing conflicts with the difficult wails of selfishness, which lead eventually to darkness and death, unless such God-forsaking Jonas shall turn their hearts, even when in the very depths of despair, to seek after God and his goodness. And when such disheartened souls sincerely seek for God, hunger for truth and thirst for righteousness, there is nothing that can hold them in further captivity, no matter what great depths they may have fallen, no matter into what great depths they may have fallen. When they seek the light with a whole heart, the Spirit of the Lord God of heaven will deliver them from their captivity. The evil circumstances of life will spew them out upon the dry land of fresh opportunities for renewed service and wiser living." Isn't that an awesome example of him not taking anything away, but honoring this young man's real experience? What he found that was interesting to him, that was meaningful to him. And so he just took that nugget and built on it, expanded it so masterfully, so amazingly, as to not take anything away from him, but only to add to that experience to make it even better for him. You know, you want to be like that, right? I mean, you want to be like that for people, to help them find a, you know, as Jesus said, the true satisfactions of living. I wanted to point out, Chuck, you had wondered who in the book said truth. What is truth? Terry pointed out it's Pilate who said that.
Oh, it was Pilate who said that? Oh,
okay. Yeah, it was Pilate who said it. Thanks for that, Terry. Terry on
it was
the point.
One or the other. Great.
Yeah.
There's a couple of little nuggets, another one down here in the last paragraph that I've found myself pondering at different times. They're talking about truth, beauty, and goodness. They say truth is coherent. Okay, that makes sense. Beauty is attractive. That makes sense. And then they say goodness is stabilizing. That particular comment about the importance of goodness, I think, is so profoundly far-reaching, especially, you know, in, you might say, present circumstances where there seems to be so much instability. You know
who
world.
I think of when I hear that? When I hear goodness is stabilizing, I think of children. Children feel so vulnerable in the world. They just instinctively know they're vulnerable and not very powerful. And so goodness, when they're surrounded with goodness, it stabilizes them. It's something they can hang on to. And there's nothing like a stable environment for a child to grow in. They grow up being, you know, fearless and willing to jump off, to try, you know, because they've come from a place of stability. Whereas when there's not goodness in their life to stabilize their lives, they kind of get buffeted about and they are never find their bearing. And I think we're just like that.
So, but it's kind of a clue, you know, when we see lack of stability. That's perhaps an indicator there's a lack of goodness going on.
Good point.
Either in our own lives or in the world or wherever we experience that.
Right. And then you have to find out where the deficit is, right? And try to correct it with goodness.
Right, right. Well, and then they talk about coordinating truth, beauty, and goodness. And that results in a high order of love, conditioned by wisdom, qualified by loyalty. But the key
a
to
higher
to
order
build,
of love.
Yeah. Yes. But just to remember that the key to stability is goodness. That's just, I don't know, that in itself is kind of a revelation.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Chuck.
Well, no, and then in the previous paragraph, there's this interesting triad, if we want to think in terms of triads, of health, sanity, and happiness.
Man,
you know,
that one
like,
struck me when Marvin read
it. Like body, mind, and spirit, essentially. But again, speaking in terms of the integration of truth, being, and goodness, as they're blended in human experience, you know, that's how we can live with, you know, reliably healthy, sane, and you know, with some happiness.
Health, sanity, and happiness.
Health,
integration.
Health, sanity, and happiness. Wow.
As they are blended in human experiences. That's like me, you know, getting up from the computer after a long day and taking my dogs on a walk. And I get out in the fresh air and the sunlight and the beautiful blue sky and the trees and the song of birds and the water drifting by and the view of the Front Range, which is always spectacular no matter what. And all of a sudden, I just let go all the cares of the day, right? And why it's so important to get out and get away from the computer and take that walk. Because that helps me integrate the truth and beauty and goodness of my life, of my everyday moments, you know? And this such levels of efficient living come through the unification of energy systems, idea systems, and spirit systems to integrate all three. Energy system being the body, right? Idea system being the mind. And spirit, obviously, spirit. Whatever's good for your body, your mind, and your spirit.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, this whole notion of sanity is an interesting one to throw in there. Again, it's one of those things where you know it when you see it. But
yeah.
And you know it when it's absent. Even though it's kind of hard to define. I was just looking for that definition online, and they're all just kind of saying, well, having a sound mind, you know, or a healthy mind. Sure, that makes sense. But in our experience of the world and with each other and the people we encounter and everything, there's just always a tendency to have this sanity evaluation going on in the background. You know, and a part of that is, can this person be dependent on? Are they consistent? Are they the same person tomorrow? Will it be the same person tomorrow they are today? You know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
The reliability of judgment, a lot of things enter into that.
I hear that old saying, stop and smell the roses, you know. What good is it to be in beauty if you don't stop to appreciate it? You know.
Uh-huh.
If it's just always a drive-by, you know, yeah, it's there. You take it for granted.
Yeah.
And the same with, you know, truth and goodness. What value can they have to you if you don't stop to contemplate them and appreciate them?
Well, the same's kind of true of negative things, too. You know, we have negative feelings come up, you know, like anger or wanting to get even or whatever, those kind of feelings, you know, to stop and evaluate those. And realize that that's not going to add to anyone's sanity to act impulsively on these sort of more animal tendencies that we all have. You know, be able to stop and evaluate in situations. That's kind of a sign of sanity, I think, as opposed to just giving in to whatever impulse.
I mean, when you're talking about looking at the Front Range, Paul, I mean, and what you're talking about, Chuck, is it is the reflection process. It's stepping
right,
back and seeing the whole the whole of things, you know, and allowing mm-hmm. allowing those things to cohere in us and to unify, to make things whole. So then they make sense, mm-hmm. you
right.
know, on a much deeper level.
There's appreciation in that also.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, the function sure. of appreciation.
And understanding, mm-hmm. too.
Uh-huh.
You have to contemplate
yeah.
something to understand it. And then you have to understand it to really appreciate it, you know,
mm-hmm.
especially when
yeah.
you contemplate. And Marvin read this sentence twice. The real purpose of all universe education is to effect a better coordination of the isolated child of the worlds with the larger realities of his expanding experience. That is such an intriguing statement. The real purpose of all universe education.
Yeah. Well, and again, they talk about the isolated child of the world.
Yes. That's what intrigues me. Are they just referring to us being isolated, or are all children of the world isolated to a degree?
Well, you know, it sounds almost like they're saying our existence here, regardless of how many friends we may have or whatever, is compared to how it's going to be, maybe even on just the mansion world, it's going to be an extreme contrast.
Wow,
like
that's a good point.
The socialization on the mansion world, which we now can see angels and other types of beings, and plus we got, you know, kids coming from planets all over Satania, you know, what I call them. But
sub-breathers, non-breathers, three-brainers.
Relatively speaking, our experience here, where we're sort of our consciousness, our awareness is mostly confined to the material mm-hmm. level, just the people we can see and talk to. I mean, we do have our inner and spiritual connections as well, but in the sense of just our social experience, it's limited compared to how it's going to be in the future. Maybe that's part of what they're talking about. I don't know.
And that's why it's all universe education.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they're doing it on this world, but continuing on, it continues on so that mm-hmm. we can integrate with the larger realities experiences.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
And that larger reality is going to be majorly social, starting with the expansion world, I think. I mean, we're going to be encountering other kinds of larger realities, but one of them is definitely going to be the social reality that we're thrown into.
It's such a metaphor for what we always go through anyway. I mean, we're born into this world. We're just this, you know, we're closed into this womb, and now we're born, and now we meet all these different people. And each little social segment, like, you know, life in your family until you go to grade school, and then all of a sudden it expands. And then mm-hmm. life, and then you go to high school, and all of a sudden expands. But still, you're always, it's a progression of expanding experience. You know, kids go off to college or they go off and join the work world, then they really expand their experience out there. And all of a sudden, you know, they start to get that broader perspective.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know?
Yeah. Well,
so that's so true.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, the other way we're sort of isolated from God, even. I mean, we're working on that. You know, we have the adjuster and all the spirit endowments that we've been given, the spirit, truth, and the Holy Spirit, and all of that. But again, compared to how it's going to be on the mansion world, so we have Marantia minds, and we have a more direct relationship with our adjuster, and we can see our angels and all of that. Compared to that, this existence here, you know, we just mostly have to kind of explore our discovery of God through faith. And that, not that that doesn't yield fruit of all kinds, but still, it's comparatively speaking, we do feel kind of cut off
mm-hmm.
just by our nature, you know, mm-hmm. physical.
Yeah. You know, what occurs to me too is, you know, when you go to church or when we have a Urantia gathering and we're all there together and we all have faith in this thing, it's just so beautiful to share our faith and our mutual
mm-hmm.
belief in it. Imagine what it'll be like to be on the mansion worlds and have everything affirming that faith.
Well, and we'll be around being able to know God better than we do.
Right. Right.
And that's going to be a kind of a revelation as well, I think.
Mm-hmm.
The engagement with the reality of God on a day-to-day basis.
Well, we're down to our last
four
minutes, guys. Any last thoughts before we wrap this one up, this paper, and then off to the attributes of God?
Yeah, I look forward to that.
Well, it's interesting to just contrast nature with attributes since we're about to transition here. What do you suppose is the distinguishing aspect to nature versus attributes, since all of them are inherent in God? Why the distinguishing nuance there?
Nature seems to be more central to God's nature, whereas attributes seem more peripheral. And when you look at the list of the attributes versus the natures, the elements of God's nature, it just feels like the nature elements are just much more essential to what God is. That was just an initial take. I know that's pretty imprecise, but.
Well, and looking at the little preview here in paper 3 coming up, the attributes of God, God's every awareness, God's infinite power, God's universal knowledge, God's limitlessness, the Father's supreme rule, and the Father's primacy. Those are some amazing attributes. So it's going to be a wonderful paper to study. And this one was fabulous. I mean, of course, we all love to quote those about the far-seeing individuals, who live there. And may we all be that,
there's
far-seeing
one other
and forward-looking.
Yeah, just
go
looking
ahead,
at all five papers and just the nature of the progression through the five papers. The first paper is really talking about the universal Father. The second paper, which we're just finishing, is the nature of God. The third is the attributes. And then they move to God's relation to the universe and God's relation to the individual. That's an interesting progression in and of itself.
Yeah, sure. And while we bring everything we learn in the first four papers to the fifth paper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You can't really talk about our individual relationship with God without understanding what we mean by God. And each of those four papers really unpack that in fundamental ways. But I keep getting the sense that, this stuff would occupy human philosophers and religionists for thousands of years, what we're reading, really in-depth study of it. It's there's so much here.
Yeah.
Well, it launches 1,000 ships of thought, that's for sure, Like I said, someone could do a dissertation on just one paragraph.
Yeah.
This one line that maybe I could highlight just kind of summarizes what they're talking about here. As philosophers, we're kind of called upon to be philosophers. They say the wise philosopher will always look for the creative design, which is behind and pre-existent to all universe phenomena.
And beautiful.
We're going to apply that to ourselves as well, I think.
Yeah.
Kind of what we're doing here in this conversation is looking for the design in all these different core elements of God's nature and our relationship with God.
Yeah,
true. Well, that's a good place
to
end,
everybody.
My friends.
Yeah.
Oh, beautiful. What a great conversation. What a wonderful paper. You can't go wrong. Thanks to our sponsor, the Fellowship, for suggesting that we do these. Really appreciate it. Thanks to all of our listeners. We'll see you next week on the Catholic Citizen. All right.
Have a great
day. Looking forward to next time.
Yeah, me too.
Bye now.
Love you guys.
Much love. Love to you.
You've been listening to the Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion
of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.